Welcome to another installment of Queer Talk Radio. This is Carter Witt. I'm going to be your guest host for today. And my guest on Queer Talk today is John Austin Bridges. I have to conclude those middle names.
Please do.
A local gentleman of note here in Nashville who, as we're going to talk to John during this, so welcome, Mr. Bridges.
Well, thank you, Mr. Witt.
So, John, it's wonderful to get to chat with you today. Let's touch on the first topic that we were going to play with, which was that your book got picked up to be used as a setup for a sitcom.
Yep, setup is probably accurate. I think that when CBS began publicizing that they were going to do this series based on How to Be a Gentleman and call it How to Be a Gentleman, I think the term they used was that it was going to be inspired by or something like that. I had never been able to understand exactly how anybody would make a TV series out of a book that was a guide for manners, but they figured out how to do something sort of like that.
Right. Well, let's do define the book a little bit. It is How to Be a Gentleman, a timeless guide to timely manners.
Do you have that? I think that's what it's called right now. Yes. There have been two real versions of it, and I think that's what the current subtitle is. And it's part of a whole series of books of etiquette for men. That Brian Curtis and I have worked on. How to Be a Gentleman is the first one, and I wrote that, but then Brian had the idea that we could turn this into a whole series, and so we've worked together on the other books in the series.
And these are timeless manners that I guess reflect a little bit of your background as you grew up in Montgomery, Alabama.
Well, actually, I grew up in Slapout, Alabama.
Slapout?
Slapout, yes. That's the little crossroads where I grew up. I was born in Montgomery. But I grew up completely out in the country. And really, I wasn't even in downtown Slapout. My family had a little farm out in the country, and so that's where I actually grew up.
Right.
And that allowed me to be interested in things like etiquette and manners and parties and stuff, and to have a sense that there was a world beyond Slapout and a place where people had nice lives and did nice things, and I figured that maybe I could be part of that one day. And so I was always interested in that, and my parents encouraged me, allowed me to do that, and would actually give me etiquette books for Christmas and such.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was something I was fascinated with. And so that's how I got a sort of basis of knowledge to do that. And also, I was brought up in a household where by some standards, some people's standards, I guess we were stuffy. But I don't look back on us as being stuffy. But we were brought up with the principle that you behave yourself and that you're nice to other people. And so I think I got some basic values out of that, all of which translates into, well, I hope, a lot of what I do in my life.
Right. The extended family dinners that were more often, and you grew up learning to behave around the table.
Well, the fact that we sat down at the table.
Right.
And we really did sit down at the table together every night. And that age is, I guess, sort of gone from the world, but we did. I mean, there wasn't any other question. If it was a night when my father, for some reason, was so late getting home from work, or he had to work late for something, that was really very extraordinary. And, or when my brother started dating, they were not happy that he was outdating and that he wasn't sitting down at the table, and that was actually a reason to be upset when he didn't show up, and when the four of us didn't sit down at the table. And my mother insisted that my brother and I both learn how to cook a meal and set a table. And so on Saturday nights, we had to make the dinner for the family. And that was very valuable training. But she made us learn how to fold our own laundry, stuff like that, which is a pretty good skill to have as life goes on.
Right.
And so it was that sort of values that got instilled in me, and I hope in my brother, I think so. And really, it makes life easier, I think.
Right. Well, and I have to say that I've been reading the second print of the first book here the last few weeks and looking through, and there's some updates to the modern world. Discussions of email and voicemail, which many years ago we just couldn't imagine.
When we began these books, those things didn't even exist. There was some email, but not, and of course people had answering machines. But the books are once again being repackaged and will be coming out in even more updated editions by the end of this year. And in this one, I mean, we go into Facebooking and all of that sort of thing.
Wow.
Because you have to, because it's a part of people's lives.
And we're still trying to figure out how to use Facebook and what to share and what not to share.
and trying to figure out somehow to suggest that while these things are great things to have in our lives, they really are not necessities. They are conveniences, really. And trying to figure out how to use them in a way that is not offensive to other people and where you're not really making an ass of yourself when you use them. Challenge, of course, is you can include information about what to do with Facebook. Well, in 6 months or something else passed. Post Facebook, because it just is tumbling forward.
Right.
But basic principles remain the same of behavior. I mean, you try not to do things that offend other people and try not to do things that really make you look like a jerk too.
Right.
And just keeping that in mind, and just because you can put this something out on Facebook doesn't mean you should. Figuring out how to be courteous to other people, no matter what technology you've got before you. But it's a constantly changing world. There was a piece in the New York Times a few days ago wondering about whether propriety and manners are going away in the South. And I think that may be true. I'm not sure that manners really have always been such a Southern thing as people think they are.
Right.
But there are just so many, as I say, there are just so many options to misbehave out there that you didn't have 20 years ago. I mean, you didn't have all this technology.
Well, I think of the, everywhere now you see a sign that says, please finish your phone conversation before you approach the counter.
Oh, or when you're standing in line at the post office or whatever, or in the doctor's office, there's a sign that says, you know, if you want to have a cell phone conversation, please step out in the hall. And people don't do it. People just completely disregard the sign. And in a doctor's office particularly, I think, you know, there's sick people sitting there. They don't want to hear this. They don't feel good. They don't want to hear you yelling into a cell phone. And because there is no such thing as a quiet cell phone conversation.
No.
There is not. You have to, for some reason, you feel that you have to speak up so that somebody's going to hear you. And but once again, you wouldn't have had that option 20 years ago. And you wouldn't have had the experience of seeing people sitting in a restaurant, two people sitting talking on their cell phones while they're sitting across the table from each other, which is just, well, it's beyond rudeness to me. It certainly shows the lack of interest in the person sitting across the table from you. And you try to keep up with it, and you try to help people realize that just because you have this technology doesn't mean that you, that means that you get to abuse it. And that sometimes when you're using it, you are abusing it, and trying to be thoughtful about what you're doing and thinking about the other person who's around you or standing in line with you at the post office.
Right. So John, do you have any Gone Hollywood stories from the book being picked up? Was this produced in Los Angeles or was it produced in New York?
It was produced in L.A. And no, I don't have any stories about that because I had to sign away all my involvement in it. So no, I did not get any trips to Hollywood or any trips to L.A. out of this. And that is generally the practice when a property is based upon an original upon original material, that the writer of the original material has to sign away any involvement in it because they don't want you hanging around the set trying to say, oh, well, this is what I'd do if I were you.
Right.
And maybe the series might have profited from my presence a little bit, but I signed that paper, and that's the way that was.
Right. Well, to complete the topic, the show did get to air three times.
Right. There were three episodes that aired. The first episode we turned into a fundraiser for the Franklin Brooks Fund, and I figured, why not? Because anytime my name's out there, if I can raise money for something, I figured, why shouldn't I? And then there were two other episodes aired. There were others in the can, but the ratings apparently were not strong enough.
Didn't catch on with the viewing public.
It seems not to.
No, it's not.
It seems not to.
Well, you know, that's a story for the fickleness of the American public. But, well, John, you mentioned that whenever you can raise money for something. And you have a very long history of a great deal of community involvement here. Of the Franklin Brooks Fund being one that, as our listeners know, I enjoy stories about H. Franklin Brooks, and so I would love to. You are a very close friend. Yeah, Mr. Brooks.
He and I were best friends for I can count probably about 17 years. He and I were each other's best friends.
As a character himself, he was quite a fixture at Vanderbilt and in the community.
He was. Franklin was a very well-known person around town. He was a very, very lovable person. And not only was he lovable, he was very loving of other people. He could figure out how to make conversations with people. I wouldn't even want to be in the room with them, but Franklin would have them in the corner and would find the interesting thing about them. And make conversation with them. And he taught French at Vanderbilt for 25 years. He was going to celebrate his 25th anniversary at Vanderbilt the summer that he died. And so he had been at Vanderbilt for 25 years teaching French, and had been very involved on the campus, was very loved on the campus, frequently voted as one of the favorite professors by the students. He was constantly being asked to sponsor various things. He sponsored the lacrosse team, of all things, and then he sponsored student publications, those kind of committees and things. But he became very involved in the late 80s with trying to convince Vanderbilt to include lesbians and gays in their anti-discrimination policy at the university. And so he, along with Casey Potter, who was dean of students at that time, and Susan Wiltshire, who taught classics at that time at Vanderbilt, the three of them sort of took it upon themselves to lead the charge. And it was a remarkable thing, and it's hard to realize what a big deal that was back then.
Well, Vanderbilt at the time was a staid academic institution.
It was, and it was not. It was not the place where it is now, but I do think that the work that Franklin and Casey and Susan did, I think it helped make it the place that it is today. I mean, no institution is ideal, but Vanderbilt is a much more welcoming place and much more diverse place than it was back then. And it was a very big deal for Franklin to sit down, being the beloved figure on campus that he was, to sit down in front of the faculty senate and talk about being a gay man. And it was really a very big deal. And he was very brave about it. And it was terrifying to him to do it, but he did it. And it worked. And it had to be somebody like him, somebody against in whom there was no flaw, in a way.
Right.
Because there really were no skeletons in his closet about anything. And so he could do that. And he did. And that's sort of my thinking in this world, is if you have the opportunity to do something, and if you've got the option to do it that somebody else might not have, then you ought to.
Right.
And I believe that's what he thought too.
Right. And so, so this wonderful force of personality, who after his death was then recognized by a local group, which then created the H. Franklin Brooks Fund.
Right.
Which is an interesting confluence, I believe, because there was actually this movement to sort of create what would become the Brooks Fund, and then he was sort of brought to the pinnacle of it later as it developed.
Right. Well, his name was put on it after he died. The fund was made possible by a grant from the Gill Foundation. They were doing grants around the country in sort of medium-sized communities to try to develop programs that would help build bridges between the lesbian and the gay community and the community at large. And Nashville was one of the cities that was selected for it. A guy named Phil Rush, who lived in Nashville at that time, had been in touch with them because he was in an organization that was involved with the Gill Foundation. And so he secured one of these grants for Nashville. And then he got involved. He took the idea to the Community Foundation here. And Ellen Lehman at the Community Foundation said, sure, why not? And it turns out that that was a much more controversial thing than any of us had a sense. There were people involved in the Community Foundation who didn't think that was an appropriate thing, to have a fund that was openly about the lesbian and gay community. And the Community Foundation deserves great respect and great gratitude for having persevered. And Ellen and the Community Foundation, I had wondered for a while why they kept featuring this fund so much. And I realize now one of the reasons they were featuring it was because some people thought it was a wrong thing. And they were willing to go out there and say, no, just get over it. This is a fund that we have, just like the Women's Fund, just like others. And it does good work. And so that was a bigger deal, I understand now in retrospect, than I understood it to be at that time. And so when this fund came to the Community Foundation, there was a small board that began with it. And at one of the meetings, they were going to have to name it something. And so they named it in Franklin's memory. And so that's how it became the Brooks Fund.
Wow.
And because everybody around the table had known him. And so that was And so that's how it became the Brooks Fund.
Wonderful, wonderful way to evolve that. and John, you've also been involved with another a few other sort of launching projects of the early days of the what is now Nashville Cares.
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly was not a founder of Cares,
right.
And I always like to make that very clear. But I got involved in it in the mid-80s, and I guess shortly after it got officially founded, after it got chartered and such. And at that time, I was working at the Tennessean, writing at the Tennessean, and I sort of thought, well, I guess, once again, it's one of those situations. I had contacts and I had opportunities that some other people didn't have. And so I called the folks at Cares and said, you know, I want to help somehow. And at that point, basically the only way that they were using volunteers then was to be buddies for people who were dying.
Right.
And I said, I'm not up for that. That's not a strength I've got in many ways in terms of strength. That was strength I didn't have. And so I said, but what I can do is maybe help raise some money and help bring some people into helping the organization. And so they asked me to be on the fundraising committee. And so one of the things that I knew was I knew the folks at all the best art galleries in town. And so out of that grew Artrageous, because I called the folks at these galleries, and God bless them, they everyone said yes. I mean, there was no hesitation. I mean, nobody said, oh, let me think about it. You know, I'll have to get back to you. And so they all said yes. And so we began Artrageous. And it went on for 25 years. I mean, there were 24 of them. There was one year we didn't do it, but that's a complex thing. We did another event that year. But it went on for 25 years and was really remarkably successful and was good, certainly good for Cares, but I think it was good for the city at large. It certainly was good for the gay community and for the involvement of the gay community with the city at large. And so I'm very proud of it.
Right, because it did bring in for an evening a lot of folks that didn't initially think about supporting any HIV or AIDS causes, and this kind of got their attention with the spectacle. And
well, it did. It was at the time when virtually everybody was being hit by the disease. Virtually everybody knew somebody who either was infected or had known someone who had died. And for good or ill, in a city like Nashville, a lot of the people who knew people who had died of AIDS or who were HIV positive were people who had some money, because they knew hairdressers and they knew decorators and they knew architects, and so they had friends, and these were people who were dear to them. And the response to it from the very beginning was really surprising. And people would say, well, I can't believe this could happen in a city like Nashville. Well, I guess maybe it could only happen in a city like Nashville in certain ways. To me, it's interesting that for the first couple of years, it was very hard to get gay people to go to it, because they were afraid because they knew there would be straight people there, and they were afraid to go because somebody was going to see them there and maybe know they were gay. And my response to that was, well, if they're there, they really probably don't care if you're gay. But after a couple of years, when it was so successful and word got around as to what a great party it was, then they started showing up. And after the first couple of years that we actually had a host committee, that was like the third and fourth times we did it, we started having a host committee. And gay people's names started showing up right along with the mayor and all those people in the same list. And then before too terribly long, and this was a big jump, I think, we began seeing the names of more women on the list.
Right.
And so it was a time when you had gay men and lesbians together on one list, which was kind of a step forward. Well, it was a step forward for the city. And then before too terribly long, you began seeing couples with their names on the same line. And that was, I think, sort of transformational.
Led to some growth in the Nashville community.
Well, it did, I think, chronicle that, and I think maybe it helped encourage that
over
the years. And so, so I think it was extremely worthwhile. Plus, it raised a pile of money, and so that was good too.
Right, right. And now there's a transition. We at the Outrageous has run, as you said, a 24-year course.
Right.
And this year there's a an anniversary event going on.
Right, it's the 25th anniversary of CARES this year, the official 25th anniversary of CARES. And so there's going to be a event celebrating that.
Right. And you're going to get to wear a new hat after this event, because you will be receiving the J. Thomas Powell Award for 2011 from Nashville CARES to recognize your your contributions to volunteer activities on behalf of CARES.
Well, and that's a very lovely thing, if I may say. It's a very, very fine honor. Tommy Powell was one of the people who, if we could date back and maybe say somebody, he might have been one of the people who was a founder of CARES. Tommy probably was. He certainly was there from very early in the days of the fight against AIDS here, because it was the people who rose up, a lot of people in the bar communities, a lot of
Steve Smith in the warehouse,
that crowd, Tommy and the drag queen community, people who just gave and gave and gave and gave and gave, and most of them are gone now.
Right.
And so when you go back and say, well, we want to get the founders of CARES together for this event, unfortunately, you can't. But Tommy was there very, very early on, and he just was tireless. If there was anything related to AIDS or related to CARES, Tommy was there. He just logically was there. And he and his partner Lee Gannon were together for years, and Lee died shortly before he did. But Tommy was just great, and so it's a wonderful thing that they have named this award in his memory, and it's really a very fine honor to receive it, because it's gone to really good people over the years, and so that's really very nice.
Another thing that I've noticed, you've been all over the map as far as community involvement. You had the benefit of working for the mayor administration with Purcell and the arts community. And there's a lot more public art started to appear during that period.
Well, I think we accomplished a great deal. And there had never been a mayor before who had established a position on his staff to be a liaison to the cultural community. And by the cultural community, Purcell was wise enough to understand that that included the music community. There had never been a mayor who had had a liaison to Music Row on his staff, which is astounding,
right,
I think,
yeah,
to all of us. And so, because I knew some people on Music Row, that's one of the reasons he brought me on too. And so we were able to build relationships with the music community that still exist. And that, of course, certainly was all to the good. And it allowed us to do things like do our best and successfully to keep the what was then called Fanfare, to keep that in town, because they were talking about moving it out of town.
Wow.
Oh yes. And that was not an easy fight. And it was a fight. It was a struggle. And that was not an easy thing to do. And things like getting Music Row involved in the 4th of July celebration downtown and things like that, because that wasn't how it was.
Right.
When we came into office. And I never will forget Purcell had gone to the 4th of July celebration as it was at that time, and he came back the next day and he said, well, I guess on the Monday after, whatever day it was, he came back and he said, I don't understand this. They had country music impersonators in the show. Why did they have country music impersonators? And he said, can't we do better than that? And so, and that fell into my lap and the lap of Marilyn Edwards, who was the director of public events at that time. And so we worked on transforming that into something that was much, much more in line with what Music City ought to have. And at that time, the radio station sponsored the fireworks, and they wanted to have music that they were broadcasting to be the music for the fireworks. And so the symphony would leave the stage. The symphony would go home. And once again, the mayor said, why is that? I mean, why is that happening? The symphony is down there. They're being paid. Actually, they were sort of donating their services at that time. But they're leaving the stage. And we've got a full symphony orchestra down there. Why is that happening? And it's one of the interesting sort of background stories. It was very, very difficult to explain to the radio station that the symphony was going to play for the fireworks. That wasn't what they wanted to see happen. And so we lost that sponsorship, but we got other sponsorship because it was a good thing to do. So
and this culminated in the symphony being broadcast.
Yes, well, it was on television. It was on national television for, gosh, 4 or 5 years, pretty much the whole time that we were in office. And so that was good for the city too, and it made the city look good to the country at large.
Right, right.
And so it was great. And so it was a very, very good gig.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was fun. And then we got to work with all the arts and cultural activities in town, and I did a lot of speech writing for him and such. So that was very successful, I think.
The 4th of July and the symphony gave us a new appearance for Nashville, more than just country music, on a national stage at that time, too.
Right. We were one of four 4th of July celebrations that was telecast nationwide. And so it was us, New York, Boston, and Washington. And so it was a big deal. And we certainly had one of the finest, if maybe not the finest, fireworks displays in the country, and I believe we still do. And it was the same company, actually, out of La Follette, Tennessee, does the fireworks at these other cities too. I mean, it's a funny thing. And but they loved doing ours because they got to interact with the symphony more, and they liked being able to be musical with the fireworks. Right. And so that was great too. And
artistic creations everywhere. All you have to do is look for them, right?
Oh yeah. And just seizing opportunities when you can. And we were one of the first things that we did. Well, in fact, the first ordinance that the mayor sponsored was the Percent for Public Art program. And because, once again, cities of our size have those, and there was no reason we shouldn't have one. And so now we have a public art program in the city. And I don't know, there were just... It certainly was not the only thing that was being done in the mayor's office, but it was a sort of untapped resource in the past. And so we did things, and then of course we're able to be involved in the Skirmerhorn Center and provide support for that. And so there was plenty to do. I mean, there really was plenty to do.
Right. So a lot of seeds got planted during your time there.
It was good, and it was an interesting thing because, I knew that this was an important step, but there was never any question about it. But Purcell was the first mayor to have an openly gay person at that level on his staff.
Right.
And so I don't mean that there'd never been any gay people in a mayor's office before, but it was the first time that there had been someone who was a close aide to the mayor and who was an openly gay person. And who, you know, and the mayor knew I was gay, and everybody on staff knew I was gay. And so I guess people in town knew it. If they didn't know it, I guess that's their problem. So that was actually a big step, too. We weren't able to accomplish everything that we would have wanted to do and that perhaps people would have liked to have seen happen in that regard, but the groundwork got laid for things that have happened with the current mayor, and who, of course, has been great about the lesbian and gay community. And so things have moved forward in terms of anti-discrimination and such as that. So it's all process, and it's happened at any rate.
Right. That's the nature of our system is... incremental steps.
Well, and it's the nature of politics, and trying to line up the votes and make things happen, because things don't happen as easily as we would like them to happen, but they will eventually happen if you do them the right way. And so I'm very, very proud of Metro Council in Mayor Dean's first administration for really very bravely passing both of these anti-discrimination ordinances, and particularly the second one, which is the one that the state is challenging.
This
now
is referred to as the can-do ordinance.
Right. This is the one that says that if you want to do business with Metro, then you have to include in your non-discrimination policy that you don't discriminate against lesbians and gays or transgender.
It's a
sexual exactly. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And so, and that was not easily won. But I remember I was watching the Metro Council meeting that evening, and I thought, you know, this is going a lot smoother than you would have thought it would have. And there were more people standing up in support of it than there were people standing up against it. And the people who were standing up against it were just saying the same old ridiculous things. And they didn't have any new place to go in terms of their language. And so with the support of really brave council members, it passed. And
it's an ongoing question.
The state's being challenged on that, and that's good. And who knows how many courts that's going to go through, but that's going to come out the right way. It's going to come out the right way. It's sad that this money and time has to be wasted, but it's going to come out the right way, because it is. I'm sorry that people are making everybody jump through those hoops, but that's where we are at this moment.
So you can look back at a lot of progress, and some of it you can definitely see your fingerprints on, and other times you were maybe just standing there going, crap, y'all go. But you care to pontificate or prophesy any things you see on Nashville's future, whether GLBT or even the city's progress? We've got a lot going on.
Well, we have a great deal going on. I love this city, and I think this is a great city. I've been here 43 years this year, and which I always say is long enough to know I'll never be a native, but it it's a wonderful city. And for those of us who've been here a long period of time, I think we realize what a remarkable time it is for this city and how fortunate we have been with the growth that we have, because for various reasons, we didn't fall into the trap of trying to grow in the way that Atlanta tried to grow.
And yeah, I've been here long enough. I can remember the phrase, we don't want to be Atlanta.
We don't want to be Atlanta. We didn't want to be, and we still don't want to be Atlanta. And it was a, and part of our not going in that direction was that there were troubles in the economy at that particular moment. And so we weren't able, or we were smart enough not to try to do things that Atlanta was going ahead and doing. And so we were fortunate in that way. We also have had, when I moved here, it was right after we had become a metro government, which is a huge, huge thing.
Which we have to point out was a pioneering move.
Oh, very much, very much. And there are cities in this country that do not have metropolitan governments. Look at Memphis. Going through great difficulties with their school systems, the county and the city. And that's the kind of thing we've been able to avoid and to circumvent whatever. And so that's a huge thing. And for Beverly Briley and the county and the city to have gone through and to have seen that and seeing the value of that is, that's one of the things that's transformed the city and allowed us to move forward in the way that some other cities don't. It's the reason we have a 40-member council, too. Yeah. But that was the deal that was cut back then, so that everybody still got to have a say and got to have a part in it. So, I only see good things for this city. I think the convention center is going to be transformational. I know there are people who've questioned whether we need it or not. I believe we do, and number one, we're going to have it, so we might as well figure out how to be happy about it. But that's going to be a transformational thing. So it's a great time for the city in that way, and also the leadership that we've had really almost consistently. I mean, there have been some blips along the way, but particularly including the current mayor, the past three mayors, just very enlightened leadership. Very enlightened leadership. And we're very fortunate that way. And the fact that we are a city that will elect that kind of leadership, I think, says something about us. In terms of the lesbian and gay community, I guess I can remember a time when I didn't think there was much lesbian and gay community in this town before I was part of it. But I really can't remember over the last 30 years a time when I don't think there was an awareness of there being gay people in the town. There certainly have been hard times, and we didn't always have a cordial relationship with the police department and those kinds of things. But it wasn't... Well, it's hard for me to talk about how it may have been difficult for some people, because it has not been all that difficult for me.
Right.
I think in many ways, yes, there have been challenges, and yes, people, I guess probably still somebody would yell faggot at me walking down the street. And then that happened during the time I was in the mayor's office. I'd be walking out of the courthouse and somebody would yell, "Hey, faggot," at me. But, and I can remember times when I had a little physical abuse from people years ago. But because I sort of don't put up with that, I guess, I've been fortunate. And also I've been very fortunate in terms of the jobs that I have had, because I've nearly always worked in a job where being gay was not a problem. Not that not everybody I've worked with has liked the fact that I'm gay, but I've been very fortunate. The first real job that I had in town was working for the Tennessee Arts Commission with the state. And so...
That had better be a GLBT-friendly environment.
Now we say that.
Questionable at the time? Was it a little questionable at the time?
Well, it was a different time. It was a time when I was actually really coming out. And not that I haven't known I was gay ever since I was a child, but it was the time when I was beginning to get the opportunity to act on it. And so I was. And there were other people. I mean, I can say this, Roy Overcast worked at the State Arts Commission at that time. And he was director of the crafts program. And I did performing arts. And I can remember that the two of us kind of wouldn't say anything to each other about the fact that we were gay. But that evolved, and so that was an environment, of course, in which I was in contact with a lot of gay people. And so then I worked very briefly with the opera company in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and which gay-wise was a lot better than you would think it was. There were members of the board who didn't like the fact that I was so openly gay. And then I came back to Nashville, and I worked at the Tennessean doing arts writing and other kinds of feature writing.
And let's point out, when the Tennessean was still the local paper.
Well, it was still, it was in the last great days of John Siegenthaler, and who was very supportive of me as a person. My immediate supervisor was not as supportive as I might have wished, but it was while I was at the Tennessean and being really gay, you know, that we were able to accomplish some things. I was able to speak up in terms of the newspaper's coverage of things like the stings in the parks and things like that. And I believe made some difference in terms of policy on that. At least they quit running the names and places of occupation of the people. At least that got stopped. And then it was while I was there that I was able to be involved in the beginning of Artrageous, and the paper was very supportive of that. The first time there had ever been an interview with a person openly talking about knowing somebody who had AIDS. And actually it was a woman whose son had died of AIDS, and she spoke up and was interviewed. And that was a big deal. I mean, it was a big deal for the newspaper. And then I left the Tennessean, and then the Nashville Scene was being started. And so Bruce Stobey came to me and said, because he had worked at the Banner while I was at the Tennessean, and he said, would you come write for us? And I didn't have anything else to do, and so I said, sure. And so I was there for the first 10 years of the Scene. And, of course, you know.
That was a raucous time for starting a new paper.
And it was. And I had a weekly column, and you know, I'd talk about being gay in it if that seemed relevant at the moment. I mean, it wasn't a gay column except the fact that I was gay writing it. And then that was 10 years, and then I worked with Bill Purcell on his first campaign, and then he made up a job for me, and so I worked with him through that whole time. And so I've really been very fortunate in terms of the opportunities that have been offered to me and being able to take advantage of them. And I hope to be able to use those opportunities in a way that have been helpful at large. Sometimes I know it can be frustrating to some people who will say, you know, about somebody like me, they'll say, well, you know, why aren't you, they'll still say, you know, why aren't you doing something else? Why aren't you doing more? But I try to do the best I can, and what seems to be right and efficacious and diplomatic at the moment, to try to accomplish things and try to make the city a better place, and you know, trying to stay involved in the city at large as an openly gay person, so that so you can pick up the phone and call somebody, and that's. And once again, if you've got the opportunity to do that and the ability to do it, you should.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And so that's the kind of growth I think that I've seen over the years. I know that there are people who are not as fortunate as I am. And I hope that things are getting better for everybody. I hope that people can feel a little less afraid when they see some of us who have the opportunity to do other things. What's so astounding to me, of course, is watching a younger generation of lesbian and gay people who simply do not have the context that I have on how they're able to live their lives in a way that until this generation, I mean, just in recent years, you would have not had the kind of openness that you have now, which I think is all to the good. The work is not done yet. And I'm not sure some younger people understand that the work is not done yet.
Right.
And that there still are people out there who would shoot them if they had a chance.
Right.
But it's just amazing to me to see that the way that the gay socializing has changed, that you don't necessarily, of course I've gotten older and so I don't, but you don't necessarily, going to a gay bar is not necessarily the center of your life anymore. And gay people can, if they choose to, you know, go out on dates and go to restaurants and whatever. I remember some
a level of integration that we didn't have
exactly
20 years ago.
And part of that is that we've become brave enough to do that too. It isn't just other people accepting us, it's the fact that we've become brave enough to do it. I don't know, years ago, I guess, maybe it was around the time that Tribe was getting started and I was being interviewed by somebody about, you know, having gay bars in town. And they said, well, you know, do you go to gay bars? And I said, well, I guess when I go to a bar, it's a gay bar. Yeah. And because if I and my friends are there, I guess it's a gay bar at that moment. But I didn't feel then, and I certainly don't feel now, any reason not to be myself. Of course, I'm not, I hope, being a gentleman, I hope that I'm not going to misbehave in some awful way when I'm out in a public place. But that doesn't mean that I don't hug my friends or kiss my friends when I see them in public. Right. In fact, I'm sort of a notorious kisser. And that's almost a reactionary thing on my part. Because I have friends, I think, who are made uncomfortable by that. But I really don't care. So
that's a gentle dig that you'll allow yourself.
Right. I mean, if they pull back from me, then I learn that that's somebody who's not comfortable with that. But I think a lot of people have just learned to put up with it. And because they're my friends, and that's how I greet my friends,
right,
male or female. I mean, I have straight male friends whom I greet with a kiss. And that's just what I do.
Right.
But I think it's the world around us has developed in lots of ways. It's certainly not perfect. Certainly not perfect. But it, that I'm just really amazed when I watch younger people who just, you know, are totally comfortable. And I know that there are younger people who are not that comfortable. But the way that I see younger people who really, you know, they actually really date.
Right.
Which is you didn't used to date. And, I mean, you would go out on a date. Or you might take somebody home, or you would, and then maybe develop a relationship with somebody. But the idea of going out and legitimately dating somebody for a period of time, that to me is a sort of remarkable phenomenon to watch happening.
Wow.
And because that's a real change in the way we're socialized now. And I hope maybe we treat each other with more respect than we used to treat each other. And so, but those are the kind of changes, some of the changes that I've witnessed, I guess, over the years. The acceptance of gay people in churches and other congregations, those kinds of things, that's a very interesting thing to watch. But once again, a lot of it has to do with the congregations being welcoming, but it also has to do with gay people being willing to be part of it too. And because they can't let you in unless you come through the door.
Yeah, right.
And so just all those things. That's the story that I've seen and that I see continuing to go on here, I believe. I hope.
Yes. Yes. You and me both.
Everybody listening to this, let's hope everybody feels that way. And because, of course, you know, you're as public as I am, Lord knows. And although, you know, you and I haven't always agreed on everything, I think we both have functions that we perform. And that's called diversity, I think.
Right. I think so. Well, yeah, we do have similar backgrounds. You know, we're both country boys from the South.
Right.
And we watched a lot of the same changes. And so I do believe that we see eye to eye on a few more things.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we've both experienced a lot of the same things, and we've gone through the same sort of things. Although, you know, we haven't always agreed on how to go through them, but I think we would agree that we are in a better place than we were 20, 30 years ago.
Amen.
And it's taken all of us doing things.
Right.
And
right.
That's how it has to work.
Yes. And the next step we will look forward to in the... Whatever that next step is, we're going to identify it later. How's that sound?
That's right. Or when we sit down again in 10 years, be able to talk about what happened in that 10 years and have a sort of lo and behold moment then as to what's happened. And let's hope it's positive. We have to be very concerned about the political climate out there. I mean, there are very good things that have happened. But as we know, there are people in leadership positions who don't like the things that have happened, and particularly with the upcoming presidential election, and certainly Congress, things could be turned around. And so we can't just say, oh, well, you know, there's not any don't ask, don't tell anymore, so, you know, we're home free. Because it could come back. I mean, it really could come back.
Right, at the moment, yeah, it's not clearly established the court cases have been stopped, so that, you know, congressional statement, constitutional statement has not been put out there. But you know, so we've got some more to watch.
Well, you can never... stop watching. You never stop being vigilant. I guess there would come a time when we could say, oh, well, okay, that's fine. But once again, for good or ill, the majority of the world is going to be straight people, I would think. And which means there are going to be people who just don't get it, who don't understand, and who don't think they know any gay people, and who are very threatened by it, because their own values are threatened by it. Of course, then you have people whose own sexuality is threatened by all of it. And so... that I think will be, I can't imagine that is ever truly going to go away. And yeah. I mean, and that you, I don't mean you go around being afraid. In fact, it's very important not to go around being afraid. But it's, but there's no reason not to remember what's, you know, just how the world works. And remember that you do have to be brave. I mean, you really do, in a way that I think maybe some people don't understand. And I guess I'm glad they don't have to understand it. So
right.
That's right. So that's how I... That's what I think about it, at any rate.
You know. Correct. Well, you know, a wealth of life experiences to draw from creates a lot of thought to ruminate on today, and you've given me great stuff to talk about. Think about, John.
Well, it's always good to talk with you, Carter, and thank you for asking these questions. Because we don't always get the opportunity to sit down and sort of ruminate and sort of assess where we are and where we've been. So this is good. I mean, I enjoy this.
So. We will definitely have to take you up on the 10 years from now. We'll do this again and see what we have to talk about.
Right. And let's hope it's all good.
Well, thank you again for sitting down and talking today with me, John. Listeners, I have been interviewing John Austin Bridges here on Queer Talk Radio. Thank you, John, for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Carter. This has been fun.
Queer Talk Radio is a Joyce Arnold production, airing during DJ Ron's Out of the Closet. Archives of Queer Talk Radio can be found at queertalkradio.podomatic.com. This is Carter Witt, serving as your guest interviewer for today. Thank you for tuning in.